From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An agreement was announced late Sunday between Greece and its European creditors after a 17-hour marathon negotiating session. The terms include a cash infusion for the country's banks, which were closed after the European Central Bank cut off funding to the country. The agreement also includes an 80 billion euro plus bailout package over the next 3 years. All parties said that this meant the end of the threat of Greece leaving the eurozone. The deal also includes 35 billion euros to be invested from the European group into the Greek economy. Press TV's Jerome Hughes was in Brussels and filed this report.
We've heard in recent days that Germany and Finland in particular, as part of the 19 eurozone countries, they have taken a very tough stance during these negotiations, and they really pushed the Greek negotiators and the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to the limit in terms of trying to get more and more commitments around economic reform proposals. And we hear that it kind of turned in terms of these 17 hours of negotiations, it kind of turned into a situation of Germany and Finland versus France and Italy, because France and Italy were much more softer on the issue in terms of wanting to keep Greece in the eurozone, wanting to compromise in terms of what had been put on the table. But Germany and Finland were quite tough, we understand. Basically as well, that Angela Merkel has confirmed as well that 50 billion euro will be needed very quickly to recapitalize the Greek banks. The Greek banks are on the floor at the moment. Monday marks the sort of 2 week anniversary since they first closed. So to have a developed country with banks closed down for 2 weeks is an incredible situation, and it really has damaged the Greek economy. So she says 50 billion euro is needed to recapitalize those banks. Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission — the European Commission is one arm of the Troika, of course — he said as well just in the past hour there will be no Grexit. So this phrase Grexit we've heard so much about in recent months, he says that simply won't happen. We heard a little bit more detail from the president of the Eurogroup. He is the Dutch finance minister, and he speaks on behalf of the 19 finance ministers of the eurozone, Aron Dijsselbloem, and he said that the Greek parliament will very quickly be bringing in legislation that will restore trust to the whole system. That's what he says. And a number of key elements, a number of key economic reform proposals have to be brought in immediately before Wednesday. That's part of this third bailout deal. And he also said that there has been agreement on where Greece needs to strengthen its reform proposals even further. So there are still negotiations to take place. He talked about product markets, labor markets, and other reforms. And he said that a fund — you made reference to it there before you came over to me — he said that a fund will have to be set up, and this fund will have state assets from Greece transferred into it, and there will be a lot of assets in Greece that will be privatized in order to generate funds. We've seen this happen in other countries where you have assets that are worth billions of euro. You know, if you put those on the open market, if you privatize them and you take them out of government control, it can generate quite a lot of money. So that's part of the deal as well. And he said money from this fund will be used immediately to service the debts, to start repaying the debts. So, you know, economists are very skeptical. We've heard them that saying that even if this third bailout was agreed, which it now has been agreed in principle, that really without measures to stimulate economic growth and job creation in Greece, that it's a case of throwing good money after bad, and that we've seen two massive bailouts for Greece in the past 5 years. The country received more than 200 billion euro, and you know, it didn't really stimulate the economic growth that was required. It certainly didn't do that, and the Greek people have been suffering from these austerity measures, and it really has reopened the debate about austerity. Now, Angela Merkel said in the past half an hour, she said that this third bailout program is very similar indeed to other bailout programs that other countries in the eurozone implemented. She said there's nothing radically different in this third bailout program compared to the other bailout programs. So she's trying to make the point there that, look, other countries have done it and other countries have come through it. But the situation, economists say that the situation in Greece is different because just the debt burden is so massive in there. I mean, you're talking about total debts in terms of government debt, national debt of around 320 billion euro. And in terms of the Troika, it owes something in the region of 240 billion euro. It owes Germany just under 80 billion euro, just under 70 billion euro, around 68 billion euro. And so these figures are enormous. So you can't really compare Greece's situation to the situations of other Eurozone countries that received bailouts. But these tax reforms, these pension reforms as well, they have to go through the Greek government, the Greek parliament, and have to be voted on. But also several Eurozone countries have to vote for this third bailout package as well. Now, what we're hearing from the EU, the Eurozone leaders and the finance ministers as well, is that they're confident that the parliaments, both in Greece, in Athens, and in several Eurozone countries, will agree to the terms of this third bailout program for Greece. And then negotiations will continue on the details in terms of the third bailout.
We'll have more on that tomorrow. The Kiev government in Ukraine is under siege from the right-wing militias that helped bring it to power in a coup in February of last year. At last report, Ukrainian right-sector militants were blocked in on the outskirts of Mukachevo after deadly clashes with police. They reportedly refused to lay down their arms without orders from their leader, Dmitry Yarosh. Civilians in the area reportedly were evacuated, and at press time late Monday, negotiations had thus far failed. According to reports from the scene, SWAT police and special units of the National Guard, as well as Ukraine's security service, had secured the area and blocked members of Ukraine's ultranationalist right sector group into an area on the outskirts of the city near the Hungarian and Slovakian borders. The State Security Service said in a statement issued Monday afternoon, quote, "To prevent possible bloodshed, the Security Service and Interior Ministry demand that the illegal armed group lay down its weapons and surrender," closed quote. The parties to the P5+1 talks with Iran said late Monday that an agreement was close. Press TV's Kavi Tavwe has more.
As Iran and the P5+1 group of countries are making a final push to conclude years of nuclear talks, China's foreign minister says all elements are in place for the two sides to reach an agreement.
With intensive consultations in the past couple of days, new progress has been made in the final stage of the negotiations. China believes that no agreement could be perfect, and conditions are already in place for us to reach a good agreement. Hence, foreign ministers of the six countries are gathered once again in Vienna to bring the negotiation to its conclusion. We believe that there cannot and should not be further delay of the negotiation.
Thank you. Wang made the comments after a meeting with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. Iran's top diplomat told the Chinese foreign minister that he believes the talks should not be extended any longer, but negotiators will work as long as necessary. Iran's presidential office has said President Hassan Rouhani will make a televised address when the talks come to an end. The U.S. Secretary of State, Britain's Foreign Secretary, as well as the Chinese, French, Russian, and German foreign ministers are in Vienna. Earlier, senior Iranian negotiator Abbas Araghchi said the negotiations have reached the most critical stage because there are still difficulties which could delay the announcement of any results.
We hope that we can solve the differences and take the talks to a level that both sides agree upon. We can't say if it will finish tonight or tomorrow, but there is hope.
Saudi Arabia ignored a UN-sponsored five-day humanitarian ceasefire that was set to begin Friday in Yemen. Riyadh reportedly said it was not bound by the ceasefire because it wasn't a party to the agreement. Press TV's Farbad Khalili has more.
Saudi Arabia continues its onslaught on Yemen in violation of a UN-proposed humanitarian ceasefire in the war-torn country. The seven-day truce technically went into effect on Friday night, but was soon breached by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia unleashed a war in Yemen with the aim of reinstating fugitive former president Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi and to sideline the Ansarullah movement. The continued Saudi war has pushed Yemen to the brink of famine. Over 80% of Yemen's population urgently needs some form of humanitarian aid, as a Saudi naval blockade has cut off food and fuel supply lines to much of the country.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is a real catastrophe. It is not very well known because there are no journalists there, because the information does not go outside the country.
Access to water has also become difficult for nearly 10 million people, with even more facing a food crisis.
The catastrophic effects on the society and on the people don't necessarily come from the war. Rather, they come from the food embargo and maritime blockade, and the prevention of all food and medical aid from entering the country, in addition to closing the borders. All of this is leading to the death of Yemenis more than the war itself.
Last week, Russia played host to a pair of international economic summits that strongly contradicted claims by Washington that the country has been isolated by U.S. and EU sanctions. Aside from hosting the BRICS conference, which featured the heads of state of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, among others, the Russian city of Ufa also hosted a summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which included the heads of state of more than a dozen Eurasian nations. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, professor of international relations and geopolitical strategy at Moscow State University, via Skype from his home in Moscow Friday. President Obama said at the beginning of the year that Russia is isolated and its economy is in shambles. And we saw images yesterday of the president of China and the prime minister of India, the president of Brazil, the president of South Africa, and a host of others meeting in Ufa for the BRICS conference, and down the street or across the street, of course, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with about 40% of the world's population and almost an equivalent amount of the world's economy present, including the world's largest economy. How isolated is that?
Yeah, this just shows you how absurd the West's, and in particular Obama's, rhetoric is with regard to Russia, and the idea of isolating Russia in the modern world, when Russia is an integrated part of the global economy and the West is not the world. I know they love to style themselves as the international community when they're trying to justify their actions on the world stage. But what we saw in Ufa this week was the real world community, the real international community. The BRICS members, the five BRICS members alone, are 40% of the world's population, 27% of the world's economy, you know, nearly a third, and that's growing every year by leaps and bounds, right. And 26% of the world's surface area. And when the leaders of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and there was actually a third summit as well, the Russian-led Eurasian Union was meeting as well. This was no small summit. This was no minor convergence of summits. This was a very definitive statement about the future of the world order going forward, because it is these institutions that are providing a parallel structure of global governance from the Western-controlled structures like the IMF and the World Bank. What we saw in the BRICS summit was the finalization, the coming into force of the BRICS New Development Bank, which, again, is an alternative to the World Bank and the IMF. As well as the establishment of a, they call it a contingency reserve arrangement. It's right. A pool of hard currency right. reserves, 100 billion strong to right. start, right. that the BRICS members will have available to call on in times of economic crisis in their own countries. And these will operate in parallel with the even larger Chinese-led Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Right.
Now, in the modern world, money equals power. Right. Which means economics and banks equals power. Right. Now that these institutions have these powerful financial infrastructure backing them, they are a real force to be reckoned with.
Agreed. Yeah, with the currency, the $100 billion that they threw in to deal with this currency exchange, it's kind of a hybrid of the basket in the IMF and of the ESM in Europe, the European Stabilization Mechanism. Only because you have a multiplicity of currencies, it operates somewhat differently, but performs this, those two functions. So you have the ability, basically, of transnational liquidity. And more and more you're going to see, I mean, you're seeing it already, but more and more you're going to see dollars left out of the transactions altogether, although these things are initially being set up with dollars. And of course, the opportunity to go and borrow money for investment in your own infrastructure and your own development without having to deal with austerity and a whole political agenda that runs counter to development.
Yeah, the neoliberal conditionality of the Washington consensus that has retarded Africa for the last 30 to 40 years.
Yeah, and other parts too. I mean, South America was in that condition, all of Latin America and the Caribbean, that's only changed in the last...
Now they're fighting their way out of it.
That's right.
Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, finally.
Some of the sideshows, the things that weren't even central that happened were major events. For example, one of the most vexing conflicts on the planet, India and Pakistan, with two nuclear-armed powers, they are brought together starting to work on the same project. And also you had President Maduro yesterday calling for the integration of ALBA into the BRICS Bank.
Yes, yes. Specifically what you mentioned about India and Pakistan, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization final meeting was today. India and Pakistan were brought in as full members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Mm. These are giant nuclear-armed powers that make up the subcontinent, Southeast Asia. It's a bit of a gamble because arguments between the two could potentially paralyze the organization. But they also have the potential to do exactly what they did with Russia and China, which had lesser tensions over influence in Central Asia. But what it did was manage them and allow them to cooperate instead of compete. Mm. And I think a lot of people, I certainly know that this is what the Shanghai Cooperation Organization intends, is that to help manage the conflict between India and Pakistan and get them working together. And so we had India and Pakistan. Belarus was elevated from a dialogue partner to an observer. And Armenia, Azerbaijan, Cambodia, and Nepal all joined as dialogue partners. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is essentially at this point, between its various levels of membership, now weighted towards full membership with India and Pakistan in, all of the Eurasian landmass. And this is what Western geopoliticians, this is what keeps them up at night.
Oh, yeah.
The idea of a cooperating, it doesn't have to be a military bloc, but a cooperative multilateral organization uniting the entire Eurasian landmass at whatever level. They go out of their way to say that this is not a military bloc, this is not directed at anyone. Between the two of them, I mean, BRICS is obviously not a military bloc, but when you have a choice of dropping billions, tens of billions of dollars into a development bank, and you're doing it with the BRICS banks instead of the World Bank and the IMF, it's obvious that they are in competition, that this is a challenge. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it makes lots of nice words, puts out the right rhetoric, but let's not be fooled. They very much have a security component. Russia and China, Sino-Russian relations have never been better in their history, and they are cooperating on dozens of military war games and training exercises yearly. They had war games in the Mediterranean, in the Black Sea, Russian and Chinese fleets, and Russia also participating in the Pacific in war games in the South China Sea. Right. And there's no greater message of unity. And it's not one of expansion. It's not one of aggressive outreach. It's not putting ships in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea, but it's saying this is our backyard. And if you're coming here, you better play nice.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you look, for example, at Latin America as an immediate historical precedent, 15 years ago, you had all these binary contradictions, and you still see some of that, like between Guyana and Venezuela and Peru and Bolivia and Nicaragua and Colombia and stuff. But they found a way to develop integrative structures that transcended the contradictions between political systems, economic systems, relations with the United States in a way that enhanced the economic conditions for all of the members, and also that enhanced the ability to defend their sovereignty, each and every one of them, against the United States.
Yes,
and
now it also vastly increased their political cooperation, despite the disparities in their situations and systems. Exactly.
So now you have this. You have the same condition. You have like binary conflicts, like you mentioned, Armenia and Azerbaijan, of course, but India and Pakistan, Russia and China, etc. And even looking forward, the way China has been dealing with both Koreas. The possibility of transcending those subsuming those conflicts into a larger project of economic and perhaps even political and military integration. And that, of course, you know, if you take a structure like that of the South in Latin America and see the strides that they've made, now take the largest economy, the nuclear protection of Russia and its technology, the population of markets and productive capacity of India, which is only growing, and the whole Silk Road that's being rationalized, path all the way into Europe, the potential is unlimited.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. The way that China and Russia are going out of their way to create multilateral cooperation in this new multipolar world order, vice the U.S.'s unipolar way of dealing things. Outside of the core NATO West, the United States in its foreign policy, and we can call it an imperial policy most correctly, demands a hub and spoke type relationship where everyone else's relations outside of that core West to each other should be directed through the United States. China and Russia with the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they're completely reversing that system of international relations, that world order. And they're saying that where we have common national interests, we can help mitigate and relieve the tensions, these tensions together, rather than perpetuate them separately.
And, of course, this kind of development is an inevitable growth on the one hand, but on the other, it has really been actually accelerated and intensified by U.S. foreign policy, with them essentially, you know, kicking out everyone from the room one after the other until everyone else is massed outside ready to take the clubhouse back and you're standing inside alone.
Yeah, just recently under 2008-2010, Russia tried once again for the umpteenth time come to terms with the United States and their, I believe, shameful abstention on the Libya, the UN Security Council resolution that allowed the West to destroy Libya. I believe, and many analysts here in Moscow believe, was what compelled Putin to come back, Libya and Syria. You can't trust the West. They are going to continue to push their hegemony around the world and interfere in other countries. And it has been accelerated even more with the events in Ukraine. You now see Russia, which had been, you know, playing a rather standard game of playing the West and China off of each other to their own benefit, you know, as many countries do. Now, just running full scale into China's embrace. And China is very happy about this, of course. Of course they've got their differences and everything, but what it allows them to do is set their backs on a reliable partner that provides what they need, energy and resources and high military tech for China, capital manufacturing for Russia in China, and then allow them to concentrate their relations on their frenemy partner in the world, which in Russia cases is Europe, and for China it's the United States, right? It's very hard to imagine Cold War type blocks resuming. We have because of the level of globalization and interconnection. But what we have is these types of frenemy type relations, and Russia and China being able to put each other's backs securely against each other, and then deal with the two sides of the West, the two-headed beast, if you will, it's a really game-changing development, and bringing India and Pakistan closer into this, both of them nuclear armed powers, it's huge. The geopolitical gravity, the gravity central of the world shifted a little bit closer to, I would say a lot closer to Eurasia this week. Did you feel it? Because you should have. I know that the Western press and governments have been going out of their way to ignore what's been going on in Ufa this week. More the fools them, because this was important. This was game-changing.
And as Russia and China cover each other's backs in dealing with the two frenemies, as you put it, the United States for China and Europe for Russia, there is also the rising contradiction between the U.S. and Europe that began really towards the end of the Cold War in the late 80s when, say, for example, German industrialists and even German financial interests were looking east at all the way towards Vladivostok at being able to redevelop everything from East Germany to the Pacific Ocean and making a fortune over the next 20 or 30 years. And that was essentially squashed in favor of moving NATO eastward instead, and of the U.S. maintaining control over Europe's interaction with Russia. And there are still very powerful economic interests in Europe that have, again, taken another hit with the sanctions and all of that, that would, they have a contradictory interest to that of the United States, and it's possible, I think, to see a split between the two in the way they deal with Russia and China.
Yeah, I tell you what, a lot of people say that here, too. And here I'm going to have to disagree with you, Don, as I do with the people here. In the early 1990s, we saw this Schröder Putin standing against or at least abstaining from the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But this is not the Europe. This is not the EU of the early 1990s. This is the Europe of Merkel and Sarko-Holland and Cameron. Right. And it's a very different place. And I'm afraid that Europe has very much, the EU has developed their own sense of geopolitical manifest destiny and their own sense of exceptionalism, of moral and civilizational exceptionalism, which is very much an outgrowth of American exceptionalism and the neoconservative movement in the United States. I don't see the light of day between them anymore. I don't think they're capable of independent action. And towards this thesis I'll give you, take a look at the reactions in Germany and France to the revelations from WikiLeaks that their own leaders' cell phones and rooms are being bugged by the United States or by the UK, and then the information then passed on to the United States and its Five Eyes allies. What did Germany and France do over this?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No.
Nothing.
But what they were compelled to do, see, there is also, I mean, I agree with everything you just said. I see the potential lying in the populations of Europe. I mean, if you look at the Syriza phenomenon in Greece, for example, and, the possibility of contagion of that, I know they're trying to smother it. I know that they're going to force Tsipras, and may have forced Tsipras to make concessions that are going to be troublesome for him politically at home, but they've made it almost more than halfway already to the Spanish elections. And if they were able to hold on there and Spain turns around, and then they turn around and look to the constituencies in the other countries that are suffering from the neoliberal policies and from having their entire geopolitical strategy determined in Washington, the potential for a sea change from the bottom up exists, I think.
I'm not as optimistic on that score. I think Europe, the European people, have to suffer a lot more than they have been for any kind of sea change like that, unfortunately.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.